From CPR News, amidst quite a bit of snow, this is Colorado Matters. I'm making my way to the studio after up to a foot of snow fell in downtown Denver. Elsewhere on the Front Range and, of course, in the high country, we're talking several feet. Then, just after the passage of Title IX, a rare sisterhood began called Sportswomen of Colorado.
Women's athletics right now are kind of the hip thing, and it wasn't like that in 1974 when the founders said, hey, what about this?
And it took about a half hour for the steamship to circle Sloan's Lake. She was called the Frolic.
It very much looked like the Mark Twain that you would ride at Disneyland today. It was a big three-deck sidewheel steamship.
Denver's lost amusement park and its storied elephant.
Are you planning to take advantage of Colorado's supercharged EV discounts? If you're in the market for a new electric car, consider donating your old one to Colorado Public Radio. You get a new car, we get your old car. And the proceeds from your tax-deductible donation mean we all get great programming. Find the title, fill out a simple online form, and schedule a pickup. It's that easy to donate your car at cpr.org/support.
Testing? Okay, we're rolling. Good morning. I just got up. It's about 5:30. And my first question is it still snowing? Oh, yes, I still see some light snow coming down. Gosh, there's this tree in front of my house. Yesterday, as the snow was piling on, it was just laden. You could feel it bracing under the weight. It reminded me of when I try to bring all the groceries in at once and I get kind of weighed down and unsteady. Well, I'm going to get ready, venture out, and share what I see on the way in this morning.
In Denver, it's 31 degrees Fahrenheit with ice. Today, you can look for snowy weather, with a high of 41 degrees and a low of 23 degrees.
Okay, stepping outside in my snow boots. Oh, it is not snowing. Gosh, it's quite beautiful. And it's gonna be a crunchy walk to the bus stop. But the streets are beautifully clear in my neighborhood. God bless the snowplow drivers. Looks like downtown Denver got somewhere between about 9 and 12 inches. But I've been scrolling through social media. There's this remarkable picture from Mount Vernon. So that's Jefferson County, sort of the foothills near Morrison. Somebody reporting 40 inches. And that was... well, that was last night at 6, and of course we know it snowed more after that. Crossing Colfax to my bus stop, and there's a bus coming down the next block. Looks like things are on schedule, but a lot of cancellations still today, so check before you go. Morning. And an unremarkable walk from the bus stop at Grant to work. This is Colorado Matters from CPR News and KRCC. I'm Ryan Warner, and let's put this storm into some context. Greg Hevener is a meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Boulder. Hi, Greg.
Hey, good morning, Ryan. How are you today?
I'm not bad at all. Do I have it right that some of y'all have been sleeping at the forecast office these last few days?
We did. Yeah, we wanted to make sure that we had enough staffing for Thursday prime time with the storm to ensure we continue services as seamlessly as possible.
All right. So is that sleeping bags? Just curious.
I had an air mattress at least. I wasn't sleeping on the hard ground. But yeah, sleeping bags, air mattresses, the whole nine yards. Kind of felt like camping, but inside of an office space.
What snow totals in Colorado stand out to you this morning? Maybe name some places and some depths.
Absolutely. So we actually got a report this morning from up in Aspen Springs, up in Gilpin County, of about 65 inches of snowfall. That's the highest we've seen thus far. But pretty much anywhere in Western Boulder, Jeffco, Gilpin, and Clear Creek counties easily exceeded 4 feet with this storm.
Okay, 65 inches. Is that some sort of record, or that's just standout from this storm?
Actually, the 24-hour record for Colorado was set back in 1921. I think it was about 80 inches.
Okay.
So the fact that this was like more of a prolonged storm, I don't think we set any records, but regardless, that's a lot of snow, a lot of water to move around. It's really a heavy, wet kind of snow as well.
I do think the variability is fascinating because, gosh, at the airport, and you know, there were plenty of canceled flights and this morning, quite long lines through security, which I believe have eased some, but at the airport, Denver's airport, just 5.7 inches. And then not far away, say in Boulder, you're talking about Arvada too. You're talking about a very different scene. What explains that?
So this was a completely upslope driven storm. The farther removed you were from the foothills and mountains, the less snow you received. We did think that there would be a really sharp gradient as far as the snow accumulation across the Denver metro area. And that was kind of how it played out as well. But with DIA, unfortunately, they were warm. They got a lot of moisture regardless, which is great. But as far as it actually turning to snow, it took several more hours compared to places farther west for it to go from the rain to snow Wednesday night and Thursday morning.
Wait, am I hearing a meteorologist say we needed the moisture?
Oh, my goodness, right? Isn't it all we need here in Colorado? Consistent moisture flow? Absolutely.
Well, that's my next question. You know, the snowpack, of course, is so critical to our long-term water outlook. It is a natural reservoir. What do we know about what this storm means for our snowpack?
Oh, it puts, you know, several more inches within the snowpack areas in Colorado, the headwaters of the Arkansas and the Rio Grande, you know, even the South Platte. So we saw the numbers across the high country when it comes to that water equivalent. So you take the snowpack, you melt it down, you get basically a liquid equivalent. That in itself went up several inches, which is great. So now we're above where we typically are in mid-March when it comes to our snowpack across the high country. So this is a great storm for that purpose.
Okay, but of course, we're also going to watch temperatures in its wake to see how quickly that snowpack melts, right? I mean, we kind of want it to stay snow for as long as possible, don't we?
Absolutely. Yeah, we're not looking at temperatures kind of moderating a little bit through the weekend, but I do think in the places where, you know, we saw, you know, a foot or more of snow, it's going to take a while, even for the places along the foothills or across the metro, it'll take a little bit longer for that snow to really melt off because, again, it is such a wet, sloppy snow.
Okay, so some advisories as we speak this morning, just after 9, some advisories have lifted, but some advisories remain in place. Do you want to give us maybe a statewide view for the next few hours, days?
Absolutely. So pretty much the storm for Northern Colorado has ended. You know, a couple of light flurries, maybe a couple more showers this weekend. But the impact now is primarily shifting to the Southwest Mountains. So down in the San Juan Mountains in Southwest Colorado, where they could receive another foot or so in some of those locations like Archuleta County, you know, Rio Grande County, and so on and so forth, just due to the moist upslope flow for those mountains continuing throughout the rest of the day today. So that's pretty much where most of the heavier snow and the winter storm impacts are going to be experienced today, are going to be in the Southwest Mountains.
We have to remember that March and April are historically the snowiest months in Colorado. And I want to talk just a bit about the quality of the snow, this storm, and this time of year. I think of it as quite heavy. I think of it as quite wet. And that certainly is demonstrated in your comments about the snowpack. How does snow get that way this time of year?
So it's all due to really kind of the clashing of the air masses. So we are now starting to get into some of the warm air masses from the Gulf of Mexico, moving up into eastern Colorado, southern Colorado, and kind of clashing with the colder, more dense air from Canada still. And really the amount of moisture, the amount of warm air coming up from the Gulf of Mexico really plays a factor into the water content in the snow. When we get into the, you know, the winter months themselves, December, January, even early February, we tend to not get as much moisture from the Gulf of Mexico. So the snow content is usually a higher ratio, we'll call it. So, you know, we'll say 15 to 1 inches, 15 to 1 inch, you know, ratio means if you take an inch of liquid and convert it all over to snow, that would be 15 inches of snow. This storm that we had was more of like a 9 to 10 to 1 inch ratio. So again, 1 inch of liquid equals 9 to 10 inches of snowfall. So as we get through the warmer spring months, start still seeing some snow, those ratios play a factor just due to the warm air that we're basically moving into the region, causing the snow ratios to decrease. So
fascinating. You know,
still a good moisture, but less snowfall from that moisture.
So it's the Gulf of Mexico playing a role here, which I think of as a spring break destination. So a little bit of spring break came to us, I suppose. Greg Heviner.
You can feel it, yeah.
You can feel it. Best named meteorologist in Colorado. Thanks so much for being with us.
Absolutely, Ryan. Take care today.
Greg Heviner is a warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Boulder. We will be right back to celebrate 50 years of a special sisterhood. This is Colorado Matters from CPR News.
Terra Firma, the podcast that brings you sounds of nature with reflections from Colorado-born writer C. Marie Furman, is back.
Season 2 offers a chance for us to see the ways in which nature allows our wildness. I believe the earth is so glad you are here.
Find Terra Firma from Colorado Public Radio wherever you get your podcasts.
Supported by Credit Union of Colorado.
It's Colorado Matters from CPR News. I'm Ryan Warner. When it comes to the story of women's athletics, Coloradans have written many compelling chapters.
Have a look at this. This is something, isn't it? The world record is 2.481. Franklin's already got 2 gold medals here. She's going to get a 3rd Olympic gold medal, 17 years of age. What a missy this one is. And look at the time.
Good away down the left, Sophia Smith is in the middle! Sophia Smith has the goal!
There are many who excel at their sport, but only a few who redefine it.
Ready? Go!
From the Rockies to the Alps, the Andes to the Adirondacks, the whole skiing world understanding the magnitude of this moment. The scale and scope of what Michaela Schifrin is poised to do.
It's a precision unlike anything we have ever seen on skis.
Skiing into alpine immortality. Michaela Schifrin, the greatest World Cup skier of all time.
While we all know about the accomplishments of Missy Franklin in the pool, Sophia Smith on the pitch, and Michaela Schifrin on the slopes, there are countless other wins here, from high school to master's level. Celebrating them is the role of Sportswomen of Colorado, the organization's turning 50. And our next guest says it's unique in the country. On the eve of its annual awards ceremony, we're joined by Executive Director Linda Lappe. Linda, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
You've had quite a career yourself. I know you're originally from Iowa, went to college at CU Boulder, where you captained the women's basketball team for 2 seasons. Then you returned as head coach and still ranked 3rd all time in wins. I guess, first off, do you miss it?
I miss parts of coaching, but no, I'm enjoying Sportswoman of Colorado, and as well as kind of my full-time gig, which is working for United Airlines. But I miss practices. I miss working with the players. I am a sports junkie, so I do miss being in it every single day.
Mm-hmm. I think you work at the Flight Training Center at United. Is that right?
I do.
A sports junkie, you say. How do you get your fix these days?
Well, Sportswoman of Colorado. You know, and then I'm very active, you know, even though I don't necessarily watch a ton of sports anymore because I got my fill watching a lot of film while I was coaching. I love being outside. I love biking. I love hiking.
Is it true that there's no organization quite like this elsewhere in the country? How can that be?
There isn't, as far as we know. Now, we haven't gone searching with a fine-tooth comb, but we've never been told otherwise. An organization that honors, to the extent that we honor at the statewide level, all sports, all levels, from, you know, most promising athletes who are 11 all the way up into masters athletes, you know, who are great grandmothers and 82 years old. So, you know, we really take a lot of pride in being the first to do that. And we're still thought to be the only.
50 years after its founding, why do you think Sportswomen of Colorado remains relevant? I mean, so much has changed in half a century.
A lot has certainly changed. It wasn't like it is now, where it's kind of the hip thing. Women's athletics right now are kind of the hip thing. And it wasn't like that in 1974 when the founders said, hey, what about this? The fact that the executive director of 40 years, Joan Berklin, left about 10 years ago, it could have folded at that point in time. And there were a lot of people that stepped into different roles and said, this is an important organization because we need to continue to have celebrations and continue to impact the youth and camp sponsorships and satellite clinics.
So you mentioned Joni Berklund, a Denver East grad who was a really good tennis player and golfer. And indeed, before she passed away in 2019, Berklund ran the organization for 40 years. It's interesting to hear you say that there's some cachet now to women's sports. Do you think, like, in the beginning, with starting an organization like Sportswomen of Colorado, eyebrow raising? I don't know.
That's a great way to put it. It's at the same time when Title IX was enacted. And so the timing of everything worked out great. You know, prior to Title IX, there wasn't really sanctioned sports in the state of Colorado for girls. And so our organization coincides with helping build that momentum with understanding that, hey, girls should have every right to play sports just like the boys do in high schools and in the youth organizations, all the way up to colleges. And, you know, the professional leagues didn't happen right away. Those have just kind of come about in the last 20 years or so. You know, you think the excitement that must have been kind of behind the scenes, and there was a lot of things that transpired all at the same time to help this organization exist and thrive.
Yeah, I think I was doing the math and y'all came along 2 years after Title IX. So we mentioned the organization honors athletes at different levels of competition. One of the honorees at the very first banquet was Debbie Wilcox, at the time a high school gymnast from Littleton, who went on to compete at CU and for the United States in the 1976 Montreal Olympics. Wilcox told us just how memorable that Sportswomen Award was.
So I was 16, I think, when I got the award. I had been to a couple of the ceremonies in previous years. It was just a shock. I had this turquoise dress because my mom was saying, well, do you want to go get a new outfit, you know, to wear to this? Oh, no, Mom. I'll just wear, you know, this dress that I had that I really liked. It was turquoise and it was long. And I said, I'm not going to win, so it doesn't matter what I look like, you know.
But let's highlight some of the women we may be talking about 50 years from now. Tell me about Ava Keenan, who skis out of Vail.
Well, Ava was our most promising athlete last year. She was I think, 11-year-old mogul skier, seventh grader at the time. She's probably in eighth grade now, I would guess. But yeah, she's one of the best young mogul skiers in the world. I did see she just won another award. So she continues to progress and get better. And, you know, we were able to get a nomination for her. I don't know that we would have necessarily known about her had she not been nominated. And our nomination process is so important that people actually take the time and say, hey, this young girl needs to be recognized and honored. And that's kind of what we've always been about. And, you know, so she got nominated. We read her story. She has some unbelievable potential to go to the Olympics. She wants to be the first Black mogul skier in the Olympics.
I really want to interview her at some point. Maybe you can make that connection for us.
I can. I can do that. I can connect you with
Harold Whipple of Arvada is a duathlete. So that's a competition that features two lengthy runs and a long bicycle race. What can you tell us about Carol?
Well, Carol won an award last year for us. She also won an award this year. Last year, she was a world champion. This year, she was national champion and world bronze medalist. And she just, you know, she is an amazing woman, first and foremost. She has taken the award that we gave her last year And she said, how can I continue to pay it forward? How can I give back to, you know, mostly triathletes? Because when people are young, they don't do as many duathletes. It's more in the triathlon. And so she's found ways to raise money for young triathletes to have the gear. Triathlon can be very expensive, you know, to get a good bike, get a wetsuit, you know, all of those things. And so she continues to dominate at the world level in her age group.
Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned barriers to sports, because it seems to me that it would be one thing for you to focus on women of means, right? But it sounds to me like part of this is making sure that women at all levels of income get celebrated and get access. Do you think that's true?
That is true. The celebration piece, we celebrate anybody that is good, you know, whether it's you're the inner city, whether you're from the middle of nowhere, Eastern Colorado. In the early 2000s, we wondered how could we continue to progress and provide opportunities for girls to be able to participate and to be able to get honored. How many girls, you know, were there that didn't have the means to be able to plan a club team or be able to go to a basketball camp or a volleyball camp? And so we started running a camp scholarship program. We started creating satellite clinics where we partnered collegiate women's sports teams with Title I elementary schools. During a PE class, they take the kids through skills and drills, and it just leads to a great sense of community. It's great for the college athletes to be in that community. And it's also great for the kids and for the teachers, you know, and we've gotten so much great feedback on how the kids are once that team leaves. One, they continue to practice their skills, but two, you know, they treat their teachers with more respect. The boys treat the girls with more respect because they just saw these really powerful girls come to their women come to their school. So yeah, just all around really great program that we've been able to just start and been able to impact so many kids.
It seems like this is a great time for women's sports. Barriers remain, no doubt. But I'm thinking of Michaela Schifrin, who, as we heard, recently set the record for most wins in World Cup skiing. Gosh, gymnast Simone Biles, University of Iowa basketball star Caitlin Clark. I do want to get back to your time in basketball, because I think it speaks to the arc. I mean, you come from Iowa, like Caitlin Clark, but when you were a kid, the state famously played 6-on-6 with players being segregated to either the offensive or defensive side of the court. I mean, tell me about an experience that seems like pretty archaic today.
It is definitely archaic. However, those girls in Iowa were playing in the 20s, right? So they were getting to play where maybe the girls in Colorado had no opportunities to play. So for instance, my mom was able to play on her high school team all through her formative years and into high school, and then actually got a college scholarship. So while the game was archaic, it was really, really neat that they even had the opportunity. And then as we got into the early 90s, really, I guess in the late 80s in Iowa, they had two different games. And then in the early 90s, they merged all into the 5-on-5 game. And but you go back to the 50s and you look at the state tournaments, they're on YouTube. They have media coverage. They have 12,000 fans there in the arena. There's a lot of great things that came about, even though the game was significantly different than what we know of today.
Ah, that context is so important. I invoked Simone Biles a moment ago. Let's get back to Debbie Wilcox. Now, actually, Debbie Wilcox Mills, talking about the evolution of her sport.
Gymnastics has just gone to another level. So I was kind of just at the beginning of Title IX and the equipment changed. I mean, gymnastics equipment nowadays, you know, with the spring floors, the spring beams, the bars where you can actually do jives. My bars wouldn't go far enough apart, right, because they were kind of antiquated. And I competed on a wood beam with no springs. And, you know, so I just think with the level of the equipment and of the, I mean, I think the coaching has gotten good too. So, yeah, it's just going to take, I mean, Simone is just unbelievable. I think she's the greatest gymnast ever.
What glass ceilings or glass backboards are still to be shattered, do you think?
That's a great question, because I think we have shattered quite a few of them, even in the last year. You look at the recent Iowa-Nebraska women's basketball game, the most watched game for a long time, I think since 1999. And now those games are rivaling NBA games. That part is great. I mean, I think that I'm not sure if it'll be a ceiling, but that I think an upcoming challenge will be how they deal with the colleges changing, you know, the NCAA moving on potentially. You know, it could affect how many sports colleges can provide scholarships for, you know, as dollars become very hard to come by, you know, as they place them more and more towards football, and maybe they have their two women's sports that they fund. I think in the next 5 years, sports at the collegiate level could look drastically different. And if that's the case, that affects your professional levels and it affects your high school and your youth, what happens there as well.
Okay, so once this banquet is over, I mean, I imagine that's a big stressful thing to put together. Do you become just absolutely consumed by women's March Madness?
Not absolutely consumed anymore. I used to be consumed by March Madness. Now it's, you know, you definitely watch and it becomes fun. There's already, I just watched the Sports Center this morning and there's already a lot of buzzer beaters that have happened even in conference tournaments. That to me, that is the most fun, especially in those smaller conferences where they don't get to go to the NCAA tournament unless they win their conference tournament. That's where I think it's really fun.
Well, Linda, I've enjoyed speaking with you. Thanks so much for your time.
All right. Thank you, Ryan.
Linda Lappe is a former women's basketball coach at Metro State and CU. She leads Sportswomen of Colorado, which is marking 50 years. Their annual award ceremony is Sunday night. And Colorado Matters continues in this next half hour with a shuttered amusement park I'd never heard of. Maybe it'll be new to you, too. I'm Ryan Warner. You're with CPR News and KRCC.
You've probably seen the signs along the highway. Your speed is monitored by aircraft. Through Colorado Wonders, you asked if planes are really checking our speed.
Having a vantage point from the air is much different, and people don't know you're there, and they continue to drive the way they drive. It's shocking sometimes.
The story of a Cessna, a pilot, and his trusty stopwatch in the latest Colorado Wonders, online at cpr.org.
You're back with Colorado Matters from CPR News and KRCC. I'm Ryan Warner. An elephant bathing in Sloan's Lake. Hard to picture, but it happened at one of Denver's first amusement parks. More than a century later, few people have ever heard of it. Historian David Forsyth changes that with his forthcoming book, The Amusement Park at Sloan's Lake, The Lost History of Denver's Manhattan Beach. Hi, David.
Hi.
You specialize in amusement park history. I guess before we go any further, what makes somebody want to do that?
I've always been fascinated with amusement parks. There's still stories in my family of our first trip to Disneyland of me just snapping pictures right and left and kind of going crazy with it. And originally I started out to be a presidential historian. When I was in school up at CU Boulder, no one was too interested in working with me on that. So I kind of ended up hitting on Lakeside Amusement Park for my dissertation. And at that point, I was just hooked on doing amusement park history. I like to do fun history. I'm still serious about it, but there's a lot of other people who do the real serious, hard, heavy history. But there's a good history with amusement parks and the role they played in cities, and why not?
And culture, I guess. And so you wrote your dissertation about another amusement park, Lakeside, mm-hmm. which still operates today on the north side of town. But Sloan's Lake on the west side of Denver, I certainly think of it as a park now where I might, you know, walk a dog or fish, maybe row a dragon boat once a year. What was it like in the late 1800s as Manhattan Beach?
It started out not as what we would think of as an amusement park, but as more what I call a summer resort, what some people called amusement resorts. They were sort of like beer gardens, but a little fancier, and they didn't always serve alcohol. There was a big dance pavilion. You could go out and row boats on the lake. They had a steamship called the City of Denver.
Wait, a steamship?
Mm-hmm.
On Sloan's Lake?
On Sloan's Lake.
Okay, Slums Lake doesn't seem big enough for that. I don't imagine that was a long ride.
It took about a half hour to make a complete circle around the lake, and the original steamship that they had was relatively small. It was not what we would kind of think of as a steamship.
I'm not picturing Mark Twain aboard.
Not at first.
Okay.
Later on, yes. But the one that they started with was pretty small. It had a single smokestack on it, a little canopy cover, and you could rent rowboats, go to dancing. They had restaurants, and then eventually they started adding more attractions to it in the 1890s.
And this is when it sort of morphs into Manhattan Beach.
Yeah, it started out as Sloan Lake Park without the apostrophe S.
Uh-huh.
One of the other things there was a hotel, and the hotel burned down right ahead of the 1891 season.
My goodness.
So they kind of had to forget about the whole hotel side of things and were focusing more on the amusement side of things. And they started putting in a bathing beach so that people could go out and swim in the lake. And originally the bathing beach was just called Manhattan Beach, but eventually it became the name for the whole park.
What was the cause of the fire? Do we know?
They never really determined the cause of the fire. They didn't serve liquor in the park, but they served it in the hotel. And once the fire hit the liquor room at the hotel, it just exploded. There was no hope of saving it after that.
Okay, so Manhattan Beach is born. And I think of that as related to New York. I think of Manhattan Beach also as related to California. Do we have any idea why they called it that?
There were some very common names for amusement parks and amusement resorts. Manhattan Beach was one of them. Okay. Luna Park, White City was another one. So you had these kind of handful of names, and a lot of them came out of Coney Island in New York.
Got it.
And they just spread to amusement parks throughout the country. So there's no connection to California or New York from Adam Graf, who started the park. It was just a good name for a park.
And I suppose at some point they upgrade the steamship.
Yes. They went through a couple of different steamships. The one that they finally settled on in 1909 was called the Frolic. It very much looked like the Mark Twain that you would ride at Disneyland today, and it was about the same size. It was a big three-deck sidewheel steamship, and it would go out and cruise the lake. They would shoot off fireworks from it. The boat played parts in recreations of battles that they would do on Sloan's Lake. It would serve as a troop transport for the actors playing army guys going out into these battles.
Is there a treasure trove of photos of all of this? Were you able to kind of step back into it in terms of imagery?
There are some really great pictures of Manhattan Beach. They're all kind of from similar angles. The cameraman would go stand in the middle of the park, turn left, take a picture, turn right, take a picture. So you don't get details of a lot of the rides that they had.
Is there an image of this elephant named Roger, who is a notorious character in Manhattan Beach?
Unfortunately, there is only a drawing of him.
Okay, and tell us about Roger.
Roger was the star of Manhattan Beach in 1891. Part of the remodel of the park was to put in a zoo. And so they brought in all these animals. There was a camel, there was a hippo. And when you read about the animals getting to the park, it's great because they get dropped off at Union Station in downtown Denver, and they have this big parade through the streets of Denver out to Sloan's Lake in the middle of the night. And they tried to keep it secret, but people who knew about it came out on their porches and saw him go by. Again, Roger was the star. Kids could ride on him. They had a special seat that would go on his back, and it could hold five kids. And he would go out from the zoo house and cross this little canal that they had running through the park and kind of make a circle and come back. The reason Roger is notorious is because he was the cause of the first death at Manhattan Beach.
Gosh.
So for July 5th, 1891, they had a big crowd out at the park, and they were giving kids a ride. And they were also doing a balloon ascension at the park. Lady Gray was the balloonist. And unfortunately, her balloon was very close to the zoo house. Roger had just started on his ride at the same time that Lady Gray was going up in her balloon. And they were never certain whether it was the balloon that scared Roger or the crowd of people running towards the balloon that scared him. But he went a little wild, and George Eaton was a 6-year-old boy who was riding on him, and he stood up in the seat. They thought that he stood up to see the balloon better, but he fell out. And Roger, in kind of going wild, ended up trampling him to death. And there were a lot of people who were very angry at Roger at first, but eventually the anger kind of subsided. The reason Roger is really famous is that the story is he was put to death and buried in a swamp near the park, which now would be in the parking lot of the shopping center across the street from Sloan's Lake.
Oh, like the King Soopers?
Yeah, King Soopers. The only thing is it never happened.
Oh, wait, what never happened?
Roger was never put to death. He was on loan from the Central Park Zoo in New York, so he wasn't the property of Manhattan Beach, so they couldn't have put him to death even if they had wanted to. But when you still read about the park and go further into 1892, he was still there. He was still very much a star. They would still give him his bath out in Sloan's Lake, and that would bring lots of big crowds in.
So you've managed to debunk this.
Yes.
Old wives' tale.
Yeah. His ultimate fate, nobody really knows. I kind of speculate there was a man named Bostock who ended up buying a bunch of the monkeys that the Manhattan Beach Zoo had as well. And for years, he had an elephant named Roger that he would take to different zoos and had at Coney Island for a while. And so I think there's a chance maybe that's the same Roger.
But that's Roger.
But
there was a life beyond Manhattan Beach, perhaps.
Yes, yes.
Historian David Forsyth is our guest. His forthcoming book is The Amusement Park at Sloan's Lake, The Lost History of Denver's Manhattan Beach. We're learning a fair amount about other amusement parks in the city. What does a park like Manhattan Beach tell us about Denver at that time, about what people wanted and where the city was?
Denver, essentially, since day one, has been trying to prove it's not a cow town. And so everything...
Well, it turns out it's an elephant town.
Yeah, that's a good one. So everything they're doing is trying to prove this isn't a cow town. Huh. And so in the late 1800s, it starts developing some of the city parks, which took a really long time, and different signs that would show that it was sort of leaving its dusty mining frontier town past behind it. Mm-hmm. And so all of the amusement parks really played a big part in that.
Well, they were leisure, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, we were very starved for open space and recreational space in Denver because we had lots of bars and gambling houses and brothels, which, you know, they're not great when you're trying to take the kids out on Sunday afternoon to do something. And at the same time, you kind of have people getting more and more free time. You start having the Saturday afternoons off. They start having free Sundays. They're dropping this opposition to people going out and doing something fun on Sundays.
Yeah.
And so there's this need for space. When Riverside Cemetery opened in 1876, people would go out, they'd take a picnic lunch, they'd walk around, they'd look at the flowers, the architecture of the headstones and the mausoleums and things like that. Same thing happened when Fairmount opened. So there's this real hunger for recreational space. And so when Elitch's and Manhattan Beach both opened in 1890, here are these great places where people can go out, they can spend their free time, it's clean, it's nice, they're not serving liquor, it's orderly. So they were really good places to go out. And then there are places that Denver can say, hey, look, we've got these beautiful parks that people can go out to and see. We're not a cow town anymore.
Yeah, and we have animals on loan from the Central Park Zoo.
Exactly.
Like a little slice of New York City here in Denver. Do you ever think about these places? Because you said in the beginning that seeing Disneyland for the first time was transformational for you. Do you ever look at the photos of these places, Manhattan Beach included, and just think, I wish I could have been there?
Oh, yeah. And sometimes it's just, gee, I wish I could go back there with my camera and take a picture of this one thing that I can't find a picture of. But no, you look at them and you think about the things that were there and the things you could have done and the things you could have ridden and the things you could have experienced. And a lot of times when I write about places, I like to go out and see them. So, you know, Lakeside, I can go out to and see what was there.
Yes. And Elitch is in a different location than when it first opened.
Yeah, but you can still go to where old Elitch's was.
Yes.
And you can see the merry-go-round building. You can see the theater. There's a little music gazebo still out there. So you can kind of picture things.
Are there just no vestiges of Manhattan Beach at Sloan's Lake?
There's nothing. I go out there and, you know, I know that the entrance gate was here. You know, it was basically at Bryant and Zenobia. And I know that the roller coaster was over on this end of the park and the other roller coaster was over here and the theater was on the corner of Sheridan. But there's really nothing to look at and say, okay, I get it. You know, I see where all this stuff was. I see where it all fit together.
Would you like to change that?
Wouldn't
it be nice to have some kind of colorful marker?
There is one marker on the boathouse that was installed in the 1950s. And if you don't know it's there, I don't think you see it because it kind of blends in with the walls now. I think it probably gets ignored. So it would be kind of cool to see a plaque or something out there.
What happened to Manhattan Beach? Why isn't it there?
In 1908, Lakeside opened. And Lakeside was huge. Lakeside stole all the attention from the other Denver parks. Hmm. Unfortunately, at the end of 1908, the theater at Manhattan Beach, which had always been one of the biggest draws, burned down.
My goodness, it's a story of fire, isn't it?
Yes. Pretty much all of the Denver parks had at least one major fire go through them and destroy big parts of it. But the company that had been leasing Manhattan Beach at the time the theater burned down, they were losing money. They weren't really interested in continuing on. And there was a big debate between the property owners and them as to who was responsible for building another theater.
Hmm.
So eventually they canceled their lease. And the guy who had been the first general manager of Lakeside ended up taking over at Manhattan Beach. And he's the one that built the Frolic Steamship and added the second roller coaster and made a lot of changes to it. He eventually got forced out because he brought in a band from Mexico that turned out to be a major financial drain on the park. And it went through a bunch of different management changes. It was renamed Luna Park for a short time. But at the end of the 1913 season, it closed permanently. And at that point, I think they just couldn't compete with Lakeside and Elitch's anymore.
Were these parks, and Manhattan Beach in particular, were they segregated? Were they whites only? Who did they let in?
They were segregated. It was pretty much whites only. But they would have special days. At Manhattan Beach, they would have Emancipation Day celebrations at the park. And so that was a chance for black customers to come out and kind of have the park to themselves on that day.
The irony of an Emancipation Day that is segregated.
Yeah, it wasn't uncommon for amusement parks at the time. It actually continued in Denver into the 1940s, and it was finally a lawsuit over the theater at Elitch's that ended up desegregating the Denver parks. Other places, it continued right up until 1965 when the Civil Rights Act went into effect. It's something that's going to take a lot more research, but I sometimes wonder if the parks went through periods where they weren't quite as segregated, because I am finding articles in the Denver Star and the Colorado Statesman, which were the two black newspapers in Denver, where they talk about having people go out to Lakeside and go out to Elitch's. So it's something that's going to take a lot more research and a lot more figuring out that, you know, maybe they went through periods where they weren't quite as strict about it as others.
More to uncover for you.
Yes.
Always more.
It never ends, which is great.
David Forsythe has written The Amusement Park at Sloan's Lake, The Lost History of Denver's Manhattan Beach. It'll hit shelves in April. He's also director of the Gilpin Historical Society in Central City. Be right back with Colorado Matters from CPR News.
Hi. The largest source of support for Colorado Public Radio comes from members across our state.
I'm from Denver.
Aurora. Glenwood Springs.
Grand Junction.
Boulder. Highlands Ranch.
With your donation, you connect your city to nonprofit journalism, to inspiring stories, and you connect your community to a wide range of music that fills our daily life. Month after month, donors continue to step up. Thank you for your support.
You're with Colorado Matters from CPR News. I'm Ryan Warner. Climate change isn't only caused by smokestacks and tailpipes. Animal agriculture is a major source of planet-warming pollution as well. It's a problem scientists have long struggled to track and to quantify, but there is a ray of hope. A ray of laser light, to be specific. CPR's climate and environment reporter Sam Brash explains the technology to Nathan Heffel.
Before we get into this laser, walk us through the problem. I know that livestock can create a lot of methane, which I bet you'll mention, but how else do these animals contribute to climate change?
So there's a long list of ways that animal agriculture adds greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. There's deforestation, there's feed production, there's manufacturing raw meat into consumer products, like, say, you know, chicken nuggets or something like that. But you're totally right about the methane. What this new instrument could help with is the two biggest sources of that gas. That's manure decomposition and cow burp, so what bubbles out of cows' mouths as they digest their food.
So not cow flatulence.
Not cow flatulence. That's a common misconception. Yeah. We're concerned about their mouths here, not their behinds. These burps are just a standard part of the way that ruminants, so that's cows or sheep, break down their food. And it's a problem because these burps contain a lot of methane. Methane is far more efficient than carbon dioxide at trapping heat in the atmosphere, at least in the first few decades after its release. The upside is that means addressing methane emissions could really tackle short-term warming. It could have a rapid impact. And by limiting it, scientists say humanity could buy itself some time to tackle other fossil fuel emissions, which hang out in the atmosphere for centuries, not decades.
So are we going to blast some cows with this laser? What's going on with that?
No. This is what's known as a frequency comb laser. Kevin Kossel is a researcher at the National Institute for Standards and Technology, and he showed me the device at the lab's headquarters in Boulder.
I basically build these laser systems and use them in different applications to measure the amount of different gases in the atmosphere.
So this essentially works as a tripwire for pollution. The scientists shine the laser at a mirror, it bounces back to a sensor, and then it reveals the optical fingerprint of all kinds of gases along that path. In a recent study, Kossel deployed this thing in Weld County in an area packed with oil and gas fields and cattle feedlots, and with some careful chemical analysis and modeling, he calculated how much methane came from the feedlots and compared it to official EPA estimates.
We found that the inventory underpredicted the amount of methane coming from agriculture by a bit.
And Kossel published those results in a recent paper. It's a big deal because it shows these lasers could not just improve these official government estimates, they could help monitor emissions in real-world conditions, including snow, dust, and all types of other inclement weather.
So how is this better than what scientists currently do to measure methane emissions from livestock?
So right now, scientists aren't really measuring those emissions at all. Huh. It's more about basic multiplication. They look at how much comes from a single cow, and then they multiply that by the total number of animals in a region or on a farm. And that's an issue because the amount of methane coming from an animal isn't always consistent. It can change based on genetic variety, diet, life stage. This laser, on the other hand, can reveal what's actually happening on the ground.
So what happens now? Can farms and governments just buy this laser and use it to get a handle on their own methane emissions?
Not exactly. These recent estimates required a lot of careful analysis after the fact. I spoke to Chris Gambino, who's an analyst who studies livestock for the Breakthrough Institute, a think tank focused on climate policy. And he wants to see this technology produce far faster results.
What we need to see is kind of a real-time or close to real-time dashboard of their emissions so that the person that's managing the farm or the cattle operation can see how their decisions are impacting emissions of methane.
That way, farmers could change up their animals' diet, for example, and see if that makes any difference. And scientists at NIST agreed that's their next challenge, fine-tuning these lasers to produce consistent results far faster so we can actually start cutting pollution from these operations.
That is CPR's climate and environment reporter Sam Brash speaking with Nathan Heffel. Read Sam's reporting on this issue at cpr.org. Finally today, music can bring kids and parents closer. I was reminded of that by a recent visitor to our studios.
My name is Nubia.
Nubia came to CPR with fellow fifth graders from Gust Elementary in Denver. The field trip was a reward for perfect attendance. I was curious about what music these young people are listening to, and the parental influence was apparent in Nubia's favorite song.
Smells Like Teen Spirit by Nirvana. I like it because me and my dad listen to it.
Is this a song you think he listened to when he was young?
I think so.
Yeah, I think so too. We are sharing music that kids today, and sometimes yesterday, are listening to. Smells Like Teen Spirit from Nirvana is a favorite of Gust Elementary fifth grader Nubia, who was born decades after the song's 1991 release. That is Colorado Matters for today, with thanks to these favorites.
Tyler Bender.
Carl Bielek.
Anthony Cotton.
Pete Kramer.
Molly Cruz.
Andrea Dukakis.
Rachel Estabrook.
Michelle Fulcher.
Matt Herz.
Tom Hess.
Michael Hughes.
Chris Ketchum.
Pedro Lumbraño.
Shane Rumsey.
Chandra Thomas Whitfield.
And I'm Ryan Warner at CPR News and KRCC.